Hello, everybody. This is Hero Cafe, Episode 2. I am Sam Drake.
I'm Cameron Bose.
And this week, we're going to talk about the upcoming developments in the Batfleck drama and our first impressions on Atomic Blonde and our deep impressions on Spider-Man Homecoming.
That's right. Now, as you just said, Sam, we have three very important topics today, each in relation to comics, graphic novels, superhero movies. But the first one is a little bit of on the troubling side. We're going to start with the bad stuff. So, unfortunately, it seems that the DCEU, which is already on pretty shaky ground, you know, they've got a little bit of a footing right now with Wonder Woman. However, Batman, you know, basically the staple of what is now comic book movies, is now threatening, or at least under the impression, that he may no longer be in these movies, which, of course, I'm referring to Ben Affleck. So, basically, let's start from a year ago. Ben Affleck very publicly kind of was unhappy with the reception of Batman vs. Superman. It was a financial success. However, because of its bloated budget and its extensive reshoots and cuts and edits and producer's notes, the movie, while financially from a numbers point of view, was also not the most profitable, again, because of the budget versus the box office. Funny enough, Ben Affleck took that very personally, and it even kind of like transfers over into the movie that he's recently released within the last year, Live by Night, which nobody went and seen, was critically panned, and it's really kind of been just a bad year for Ben Affleck. Now, for me personally, it's very strange that he took all of that reception very, like, kind of poorly that he has, just because when I was reading reviews for Batman vs. Superman, which anybody that knows me has to know this, I am like a review junkie. So not only do I like to do my own reviews and have my own opinions about movies, but like I know when social embargoes lift for Twitter reviews. I know when the actual embargo lifts for the movie reviews. I love taking in all the information and just seeing other people's opinions, because it's kind of like a hype level thing for me. Like, I just love reading about a movie that's going to be coming out. Like, it helps me temper my expectations, let's just say that. Or it helps elevate them to a level that is, you know, probably not possible. So really, they're almost not good for me at all, but I love doing it anyways. I remember about 2 years ago now, the reviews came out, and oh boy, here we go. You know, Batman vs. Superman's a mess. But not once did I ever hear anything bad about Ben Affleck's performance. In fact, if anything, the one thing that was completely unified against all of these reviews, all of these social embargo lifted Twitter reviews and reviews on websites and everything later, was that Ben Affleck is a solid Batman. That's what I got out of all the reviews anyways. So then to find out that he comes and he takes all of this very personally, it's a little bit strange to me. And so now, here we are 2 years later, Justice League is coming out in literally a couple months. This happens right the day before they go out to Comic-Con and promote Justice League, is this huge article from The Hollywood Reporter that not only is Ben Affleck possibly not going to be Batman, but the DCEU themselves, Warner Brothers as a company, is looking into ways to release Ben Affleck from his Batman situation gracefully, is how they put it. They are gracefully going to find a way for Ben Affleck to exit this franchise. And that's super bumming for me, because I actually really like his Batman, and like, we've only seen him twice, technically. But I think he looks solid, and I think it's a different Batman that we haven't seen. So, Sam, kind of give me your overall impressions about this before we really, really dive in.
Well, okay. First off, I will agree. I thought Ben Affleck was a great addition to Batman, especially in light of the fact that everyone was super skeptical before they got to see him on screen, because all we had was Christian Bale and Val Kilmer.
Exactly.
And I love Christian Bale as Batman, but I think one of the first things I pointed out back in the hype leading up to Superman versus Batman, Batman versus Superman, like, no one thought Christian Bale was going to be a good Batman either, right?
Right.
Like, he was unpopular choice. Ben Affleck has been doing really well, I think, as Batman. I think, you know, there's the brand new Batman, right, which is what we kind of saw with The Dark Knight, with Christopher Nolan's trilogy.
Right.
But there's this whole other side to Batman in the comics that is grizzled, experienced, sure of himself, but reserved instead of brash, right? And I think Ben Affleck was that 100%. I thought he was great. However, this news is not surprising, especially given the rationale that we were told in the Hollywood Reporter article. It seems like the biggest issue is the upcoming Batman trilogy that's coming up, that's planned. And who's the director on that? Remind me of that one again.
So the director is now Matt Reeves, who is the director of both Dawn and War for the Planet of the Apes.
Which are fantastic movies.
Amazing.
There's already existing evidence of a shift or a schism between Ben Affleck and Matt Reeves. Ben Affleck had written a whole script for this new upcoming Batman movie that Reeves canned as soon as he got brought onto the production.
Right.
It seems like the other big reason that they're looking to release him is because he's old, which is kind of... It doesn't make sense, except for when it does, and he's especially old compared to his Justice League co-stars, who are all in their 30s, and Ben Affleck is pushing 50.
Yeah, the only person in the entire DCEU that is basically a main stapled character that is even close in age to Ben Affleck is Jared Leto's Joker, which, again, not well received. I don't think there's enough there to judge, but that's not what we're here to talk about. So, yeah, no, you're completely right, and... That's kind of what I gathered from it, too. Like, they're planning a trilogy, which is completely reasonable because Batman is basically a total cash cow. So put out as many of those things as you can. A trilogy is always nice. That's what we like to see. That's kind of just the franchise world we live in right now, is trilogies and franchises are the big thing. But however, you know, Matt Reeves is, like you said, amazing. So I'm down for a Matt Reeves trilogy, especially since he didn't exactly get to do a trilogy per se for Planet of the Apes, because he didn't get to do the first one, even though the first one's great. So yeah, that for me, another, you know, log in the fire is that Ben Affleck was the original writer and director. He also was going to be the director of this movie. Now he, you know, cast Joe Manganiello as Deathstroke in his script. We even saw test footage of the costume already very early onto the announcement that he was just putting Deathstroke in the movie. A lot of people actually kind of thought it was going to be something they would push into Justice League as like a cameo or something, and very much sounds like that's not happening. So anyways, and so there's basically all this information now. All of a sudden Ben Affleck has a bad movie come out, Live by Night. I haven't seen it actually, which is surprising. So I can't really comment on whether it is good or bad, but I've heard things from some people that they liked it, other people not so much. So either way, it was not a hit. Let's just say that. So, and it was definitely not a financial success. And so not long after that, Ben Affleck steps down as the director of the Batman. It's very unclear whether or not he's even going to be the Batman in this movie for a very long time. Reports come out then kind of clearing that up, that he's going to be in it, this and that. And then Matt Reeves, not long after, is hired as the director. And basically, my problem with all this is, like, we're kind of making a big deal about the fact that he throws out the script. And I'll tell you, that happens so much in Hollywood that to me it's almost a non-story, especially when you have a new director come on. Because somebody like Matt Reeves was a writer first and then got into directing. So it makes sense to me that he would want to rewrite the script and not inherit somebody else's vision of the movie now that he's going to be directing it. And I assume that was something that was very clear, I think, when he was brought on, and it just kind of became this after story of like all this drama. That's just my opinion on it. Of course, I have no real substance for that. You know, I can't confirm or deny that at all, but it just makes sense to me, so it doesn't bother me. And a lot of times when somebody comes in and they start writing a new script for this movie, a lot of times the script beforehand is still integrated into a new script a lot of times. Like, I almost completely 100% believe that no matter what is thrown out of this Ben Affleck script, I truly believe Deathstroke is still going to be the villain. Now, Joe Manganiello has been interviewed many, many times since all of this news, and he can neither confirm nor deny that he's now in the movie at all. So, but he's being very, very shifty about it. So I feel like there's a lot of negotiation still happening right now, and I don't think where it's going to be clear anytime soon about all of this. But I really do believe that I think if there's anything that carries over from the Ben Affleck script, I do think that Deathstroke is the right way to go, especially for an older Batman. I think that's such a cool freaking story, man. And it'd just be really nice to see a Batman movie that has a different villain. That, you know, that's one of the things that we commend Christopher Nolan with doing in his Dark Knight trilogy was, in his first movie, he did something that nobody would have expected. He did the Scarecrow and he did Ra's al Ghul. You know, two people that cinematically should have been basically almost impossible to do. So that's what I want to continue to see. I want to continue to see these Batman movies be different and be new. So to have somebody like Deathstroke, I think, is great and has a lot of story potential. So I really do think a lot of this drama is just, it feels like white noise to me. But you can't sit there and see all of this for the past basically 2 years that this has all been going down and not be worried. Like, it's hard to be 100% optimistic, skipping through the daisies, when you have stuff like this coming out almost every freaking week. You know, so that's kind of where I fall on a lot of this.
Well, and to your point that dropping Ben Affleck as writer and director is kind of a non-issue, I pulled up, just to make sure I was giving accurate information this week, I pulled up the IMDb page for him as writer and director.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got two great movies. Good Will Hunting, he wrote Good Will Hunting, and he wrote The Town, and he directed The Town. And so these are great movies.
Oh, yeah.
It's hardly a laundry list, right? It's solid entries, right?
Live by Night basically is like an outlier. Like Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, all of these guys have a few bad movies in their repertoire. If this is one of Ben Affleck's, then that just means that his next movie should be amazing. You know, like, you learn from your mistakes, continue on. And mm-hmm. It also should be said that not even a couple months ago, a story came out that he admitted himself into treatment for alcoholism, which has been an ongoing issue in his family altogether. And that he's come out of that and seems to be doing well and all of this. And a lot of people kind of attributed a lot of that to the reason why he did step down as the director for the Batman. So again, it's just kind of like there's a lot of different reasons for all of this happening, and a lot of it's probably connected and all this stuff. But basically, again, it's just like I just feel bad for the dude. He went through a divorce. He's been divorced now too, you know, in the last two years. I think it happened within the year. It's just like it's all kind of just crashing down around the guy. Yeah. And all we can talk about is how awful the Batman's gonna be. A movie that isn't in production, a movie that we haven't seen. So it is kind of just one of those things where I'm just kind of tired. I'm just tired of hearing about it. I'm just like, you know what? Just tell me when the movie is coming out. Tell me when it's in production. Tell me how great this movie's gonna be. But it's just like, let's just kind of let this all happen. Because what we say and what we're contributing to all this, I don't think is helpful at all. Anyways, I love Ben Affleck. I have to admit it. I've loved him for a very long time. I loved his acting. I loved his directing. I think he's one of the very rare few that is actually a better director than he is an actor. Again, his first directorial debut was Gone Baby Gone, a movie that he does not star in, which I think is a huge credit to him that he was able to do that. He put his brother in front of the camera. And that movie's amazing. And then he went on to do The Town, again, is amazing. And then he went on to do Argo, which it's like people forget. We forget so easily, but Argo won Best Picture. Let me repeat that, just in case we didn't hear that. Argo won Best Picture. He got The Shaft, because he did not even get a director's nomination. Whatever. That's, you know, we're all still sour about that, because he should have. But he won an Oscar. He won an Oscar as a producer because that movie won Best Picture. So Ben Affleck is a great director. And again, all of this is just like, I was super bummed. I was super bummed when he dropped out as a director, because I want to see a Batman movie directed by Ben Affleck. But, you know, if that's not supposed to be, then really Warner Brothers did the right thing. And I have to commend them for it. They sought out talent and they got Matt Reeves. I want to see a Batman movie directed by Matt Reeves. So it doesn't, that's one of the one things in the DCEU that doesn't feel like a Band-Aid to me. It doesn't feel really reactionary. It actually felt like a smart move, because coming off of the massive success that Dawn and War is, that's a huge poach, because he could have stayed in the 20th Century Fox camp. Instead, now he's part of the Warner Brothers family. So I just want this movie to be made at this point, you know. And
well, this is the hazard of dealing in rumor and speculation, right? It's so right. Nebulous and formless that we have nothing to go on. But it is out there. You will hear about it probably. Some know-it-all at Thanksgiving will say that he's not going to be in the Batman anymore, and you can shut him down. Cameron, your final word is overblown, right?
Yeah, I think it's overblown. Again, I think there is cause for worry. It's something that we haven't really touched on very much, but this is kind of running long, so we should probably hurry. But the article does state that Warner Brothers is also looking to possibly release him from his contract. So that's probably the most worrying thing to me, is that if the studio is so unconfident that he will stay, that makes me unconfident that he'll stay as well. But again, I don't, to me, the only evidence of a huge shift in the DCEU right now is actually not a Batman story. It's actually a Flash story, because during Comic-Con, Ben Affleck denied all the rumors, because again, Hall H was a day after this article. So like a good moderator, Chris Hardwick asked Ben Affleck about all this. And it's pretty clear that Ben Affleck dodged the question, but he said that he loves playing Batman. He wants to be a part of Matt Reeves' Batman. But again, they also announced during this Hall H panel that Flashpoint is going to be the title of the Flash movie. Anybody that knows comics knows that Flashpoint is never good for the universe as is. So,
no.
If they want him to exit, and they want him to exit gracefully, Flashpoint will do it. I see a trail of crumbs, and I'm just refusing to believe that they lead to Ben Affleck's exit. But only time will tell. That's really the whole point of this. Is like, it's very much a non-issue until it happens or doesn't happen, because again, anything we say is not going to actually affect this one way or the other. So,
all right, developing story, and you can count on us to stay on top of it, but for now, don't give it too much weight.
Definitely. So moving on, we have a kind of a movie review, impressions. We'll do non-spoiler, but there is something in particular that kind of treads the spoiler territory that I want to talk about, but I'll kind of give you the heads up on that one. So we're going to be talking about Atomic Blonde. Stars Charlize Theron, beautiful, beautiful South African woman after my own heart, because I'm also from South Africa of America, Kansas, and
kind of,
yeah. No, and it has Sophia Boutella. It's directed by David Leitch, who is the new director for Deadpool 2, so it's very relevant to all of this. Even more so, it's based off of a graphic novel called The Cold City. This movie takes place in the era of the Cold War. It takes place technically 1 week before the Berlin Wall comes down, and Charlize Theron is an MI6 agent who is sent to Berlin to recover the body of a former MI6 agent and also get in contact with a operative over there to find a knock list, which has, of course, basically the identities of all these agents from multiple agencies, including CIA, including Soviet Union, all this stuff. I'm going to let you kind of give your impressions first, Sam, since I've been rambling on for a long time. And then I'll kind of just jump in where I need to. So what did you think about Atomic Blonde?
So I liked Atomic Blonde for what it was. I think my major first impressions, if I had to put it in one sentence, it would be heavy, heavy on the style, heavy, heavy on the action choreography, and the rest of the elements aren't so weak that they pull those elements down.
Okay. Yeah, we're on the same page.
Story is good enough. Characterization was good enough. I enjoyed, Dan McAvoy? Is that...
Yeah, James McAvoy.
James McAvoy. I always want to call him Dan. So I really enjoyed James McAvoy's character. I liked it a lot. I think the only disappointing part of this movie was a shoehorned in subplot, which I think we probably know what we're talking about. I didn't think tracked along with the rest of the movie at all. And the fact that it follows a pretty standard spy movie, spy novel sort of line to the story.
Right.
And I think, you know, part of why they did that was because that's what the graphic novel did.
Mm-hmm.
Part of why they did that also was because if you don't have this distracting story, then it allows the elements of the fight scenes and all the art direction that goes into this movie to really shine through. And I thought those were the strongest points of this movie.
Totally. I'm pretty much right there with you, man. I think the action choreography was top notch. Same people that did John Wick. So it's kind of just something that I went into the movie expecting to be good, and it completely met those expectations. And the third act fight scene, basically a one-track shot, was amazing. It goes from a stairwell to a car chase seamlessly, and it's pretty great. So that's like the highlight of the movie. This movie had a lot of style, which again is something that I like to see, especially going into Deadpool 2. I like to see that he has kind of that visual flair that Deadpool 2 is going to need to have. So I'm very excited about that. Yeah, really my main problem with the movie, and I thought everything else was really great. Acting was great. You said James McAvoy, or I'm sorry, McAvoy. I always say that for some reason. He was great. I did. I thought his acting, I mean, he's so awesome. I love that actor. And his character was really entertaining. I loved seeing him on screen. And I think his interaction with Charlize Theron, who was also great as her character, that was really like a backbone of the movie to me. Like, I just wanted to see them get together pretty much the whole time. We'll probably get into this in a little bit more of like a negative side, but I thought Sophia Boutella did a great job as acting as well. Her character was a little bit different than what I was expecting, so it surprised me in that way. Again, kind of like you said, I think where you're going with that unnecessary subplot, which I can tend to agree. Really, my main problem with this movie isn't necessarily even like the subplot issue. My main one, and it took me a while to kind of put my finger on it, but I was, all of the motivations in this movie are so muddled. And there's a particular character's motivations that are muddled for good reason, which we don't find out until later. It's really James McAvoy's motivations that I kind of had a problem with. Like, I liked his character so much, but where we end with his character is where I just can't put my finger on it. And it bothers me a little bit too much. Not enough to, like, ruin the movie for me. I recommend people go see this movie. I think it's fun. But at the end of the day, like, I kind of get frustrated trying to figure it out. And so it was just kind of like one of those things where I was like, ah, man, I wish they could have just cleared that up a little bit. I think it would have made the ending hit a lot harder too. But again, it's a spy movie. And so it's unfortunately one of the common problems with these spy movies too. Like, if you're not super clear on where characters are at and how their different threads come together, it can kind of make for a disjointed mess, I guess you could say. Which, again, it's not really completely disjointed or anything like that. But, yeah, anyways, that's really my biggest issue. And if there's anything I can say, and this is kind of where I was going to point to like a mild spoiler, there is a particular ending, the very ending of this movie, I thought hit so close to home for me. I kind of loved it. I wasn't sure how I would really range in this movie. And then I watched the last 5 minutes of this movie and I was like, okay, you got me. I was like, I don't know if it makes sense. I'd have to go see the movie again just to try to figure it out, but I'm all in. It hit close to home for me. And it wasn't until later that I went to some research that they changed the ending from the graphic novel for the movie. Kind of similar, but they changed the country. So anyways, I was all in though. I thought that was awesome. So I was just like, when I came out of the movie, that's what really got me. Like, I was thinking about that for a long time, actually. But yeah, no, I enjoyed it. It had fun action, decent story, but great acting all around. So
yeah, I think going back to the issues with McAvoy's character, I think part of the issue is that both Theron and McAvoy's characters are similarly adrift or reactionary, right? A big point of these spy movies is that they've done so many terrible things and they're so in deep, right? That they don't really actually know why they're doing what they're doing. And part of the way that's reflected in the storytelling is that we don't really know why they're doing what they're doing. And their actions actually aren't contiguous, right? They're duplicitous on purpose. And the difference is that Charlize Theron's motivations get tied up in a nice little bow at the tail end of this movie, and McAvoy's do not. And so all we're left with is a rather shallow last line that didn't feel like it didn't feel satisfactory to me to explain all of his actions. And it really was I thought they did that character dirty, because he really was a backbone to the style of this movie. And they ended his arc with kind of he had to serve a function in the plot.
Yeah, it was very much kind of he ended as like, I don't know, his character's ending arc was almost tied to like a revenge plot type thing. It just felt, I don't know. Yeah, it kind of, it felt unnecessary. I just wanted something more because he was such a great character throughout that I didn't want to see his character not get the credit he deserves at the end. I'm glad you kind of feel the same way, just because that's really the only thing that left me really unsatisfied with the movie.
Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah,
because they reveal so much at the end about both of their characters and why they're doing what they're doing, except it just didn't feel like that for him. Like it really just felt like, okay, you've gotten us to this point and you know, that's it. Like we're not gonna find out anything else. So yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's really where the crux of my issue, because you just, you know, they both do things throughout the movie that you're just like, holy cow, you know. And but I never felt like I could understand, like when I go back and watch the movie, it's gonna frustrate me trying to figure out what he's doing and how mm-hmm. he ties into all of it watching it again, just because I'm not gonna get any kind of answers towards finding that out. So
right.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah, outside of that though, I was like, okay, you know, it was very much like John Wick. It's hard not to compare the two because they are so similar. I think the difference that's between John Wick and this is that John Wick, one of the reasons why that movie is so successful is that it has such a simple story, and it really, they really drive in that fact. And then they kind of just like, they give you this really intriguing world, where I felt like this movie was a little bit of the reverse, and the fact that it was still very stylized, still very action packed. But in this one, the world is actually very simple, and it's actually the story that they try to overcomplicate, and it kind of just, it doesn't work as well.
Especially not for what, I mean, at its core, it's a flashy action movie.
Yeah.
Right?
It's what it's marketed as, but it almost doesn't feel like that when you're watching it.
So I think without a spoiler-filled review, it's hard for me to get into the other thing I don't really care for with this movie. So I think I'm good to call it. My final word is, if you like John Wick, you're going to like this movie.
Yeah, yeah, I'm the same way. I think it's a good B, you know, kind of a B action movie that is like a top-notch B action movie. Again, like, it's not without its problems, but it's gonna be successful because, again, like, the budget can't be too high on this, so you know, yeah, it's gonna make back its money. And whether or not we get a sequel or not, I think is up in the air, and I don't need one. But again, if it makes enough money, then believe me, the studio will get it done. But
yeah,
it's kind of just a one-off to me, and it's entertaining. You know, it's I think it's right at about 2 hours, so it's kind of just like, okay, cool, mm-hmm. great. I'd say great for a streaming watch. They should put that up on Amazon Prime or Netflix.
Man, for if I recommend something for streaming, that basically means there's no point paying money to see it.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. I do think, yeah, I don't know. I think it's a great matinee watch. How about that? Middle ground?
Yeah, that's when I went to go see it, and I was pretty happy with it.
Yeah, matinee watch. Don't go pay full price in the evening time. Save that for Dunkirk.
For real.
Yeah, for real. And Dunkirk's shorter, and it's still a better experience. But onto our kind of our next thing. And this one, you're going to kind of get a very genuine reaction from me. We're going to be talking about Spider-Man Homecoming, which I have seen, yeah, I've seen it 3 times. So now, what I didn't know, you've just now seen this movie, and it's been out for weeks.
Yeah, so okay. So I have this interesting problem. It's kind of a first world problem, okay. Or maybe like a relationship problem that's not really a problem. Okay. My wife loves superhero movies in general.
Goodness.
And what this means, one, that's really fun, okay? We have something that we enjoy to do together and that we really like talking about and enjoying together. It also means that I can't just go see this on a matinee by myself, especially not the first time. I have to go see it the first time with her.
Sure.
And when your wife is at work or tired, a lot of times the opportunity does not present itself until 3 weeks later. It turns out I didn't really need to go through all that, because when I talked to her about it, she thought it looked like it was interesting, but she wasn't really like super involved with going to go see it, and so I totally could have gone to see it anytime I wanted to. But so as a consequence, I just recently saw it, and I love it. Spider-Man's always been one I really enjoyed, and this is no exception.
All right, here's your last chance, listeners. We're going full spoilers right now because I have to get just an absolute reaction from one of the greatest things ever in this movie. So when he opens the door and it's freaking Michael Keaton that answers that door, how amazing is that? It is the greatest freaking thing I've seen in a theater in such a long time. This movie, I love it to death too, but it wasn't until this point in the movie where I was having such a blast because I went and seen it 3 times opening weekend. The first time I went and seen it, man, my theater just lost it, dude. Like, it was so awesome to be in the theater with a packed room experiencing that because, dude, everybody just, like, collectively lost their stuff. It was just because it really does. Like, it feels like it comes out of nowhere, but the genius of this movie is that it does not. I can say because I've seen it 3 times, I have looked so closely for subtle hints about him being Liz's father that... Mm-hmm. I picked up on different things throughout the movie, and it just makes me love the movie more. That it because Kevin Feige basically said that they started from this moment, and they just kind of like went back and wrote everything else to lead up to that, which is so genius. Like, I love that that was such a like that was going to be a thing first, before anything else. They didn't just throw that in there like any other movie probably would have. They actually built kind of the movie around that reveal. So that way it works. But yeah, Marvel is always said to have a villain problem. Outside of Loki, basically every other villain, a lot of people have really given a hard time. Some for good reason. Others I disagree with completely. That's a kind of a different conversation. But I think that if there's anything that can be said, this is very much the step in the right direction. I think this is actually a solid hit when it comes to a Marvel villain. And it's somebody that I am really excited they didn't go the Marvel route and they didn't kill him. I think that he is easily going to be somebody, well, not easily, because they're going to have to pay a crap ton of money, but I think he's going to be something that is is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, well, the Spider-Man universe specifically, for quite a while, actually.
Okay, so I have to get something off my chest here real quick. And
To
really give the context, we need to kind of go into the background of the production of this movie.
Okay.
So, Spider-Man as a property was licensed by Sony, correct? Ages and ages ago, back when we first got the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies.
Well, yeah, even earlier, the 90s, Marvel was going bankrupt, and to save themselves, because it was the decline of the comic book age, they had to license out characters to Hollywood. And it saved them from bankruptcy. It's actually the only reason that Marvel is what it is today. They licensed Spider-Man to Sony and the Fantastic Four and the X-Men to Fox, the Hulk to Universal Studios, and kind of a mixed bag everywhere else. But yeah, the main staples of the comic book world were basically sold off to these studios, and they limped along until they kind of got their feet back underneath them.
This is the exact reason why we have Iron Man 1 as the very first movie that Marvel launched their aspirations as a production company with, because it was the one that they still owned.
Yeah, they didn't have Spider-Man, they didn't have X-Men, they didn't have the Fantastic Four, so they had to go with, at the time, it's hilarious to even call it this now, but they had to go with a B-level superhero, Iron Man. That's right, Iron Man was once considered B-level because now you put him in a movie and it's guaranteed to make $2 billion.
Exactly. So yeah. So this is the reality going back, and so so Sony did their thing. They were very successful with the Tobey Maguire movies. People have a mixed bag of feelings about number three. Just about everyone I know really enjoyed watching one and two, especially at the time, without all these newer movies to compare them to. And so they made Spider-Man 3, and then they sat on their license for quite a while. And part of those licenses, just you can't make a license without a sort of a time bomb attached to it.
Right.
And Sony found themselves in the situation where they needed to make a Spider-Man movie, or the rights were going to revert to Marvel, who, at the time, was doing really, really well with all their movies. And they knew that it was worth too much to simply just allow to go back to them. So they made a movie that a lot of people really enjoyed. I enjoyed more than others, called The Amazing Spider-Man, starring James Garfield, Emma Watson as That's her name? Emma Watson?
Yeah. So Andrew Garfield, not James. I can hear the commenters already. He doesn't know his movies. So Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker and Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Emma Watson is someone completely different.
Exactly. Different franchise.
Different franchise. So Amazing Spider-Man did really well. Amazing Spider-Man 2 did okay. I enjoyed it. It got panned. And I cannot sit here. I am probably the person in my friend group that enjoys it the most, and I cannot stand on a hill and die on that hill, because it was good. It was not fantastic, right? And so Sony found themselves in kind of a spot, because they had the Spider-Man franchise, and they really didn't have a whole lot to do with it. And this entire time, Marvel is kind of knocking at their door, being like, hey, when are you going to let us use Spider-Man? And Sony's like, never, go die, right? So right after Amazing Spider-Man 2 comes out, a whole bunch of Sony emails leak. It turns out none of the women in movies were getting paid as much as the men in movies. And along with a whole lot of other things, we found out that there had been quite a bit of talks between Marvel and Sony. And Sony insisting the opposite were in fact just lying to all the fans. And this caused an uproar, and some would say a revolt, in the fan base, who were tired of Sony making Spider-Man movies, and they wanted it to go back to the people who knew what they were doing, which at the time was Marvel. Still is, but it wasn't before. And so Marvel has had to drag Sony kicking and screaming to the negotiating table in order to let Marvel do something amazing with Spider-Man, right? And they got him into Civil War, and it was a great debut. I loved him in Civil War.
Oh, yeah.
And a big part of that is that Marvel got a whole lot. I think it was the Marvel creative team that made Spider-Man Homecoming. And you can get into the details on this. But again, Sony is not really willing to let go of their interest in Spider-Man.
No.
And so I had to sit through, you know, the Marvel logo is a long one. The one that shows right before the movies, it's a long one with the turning pages and all that kind of stuff. I think it's like 5 hours long. And I had to deal with this Sony logo at the front and the back that was just as long, and all it was Sony, white letters, black screen. And I could not roll my eyes harder, because if it was up to Sony, this movie wouldn't exist. But they're still going to take all the credit for it. I had to get that off my chest, because I hate these guys.
Yeah. Anybody that knows me knows that I hate, and I mean deeply within my soul, hate the Amazing Spider-Man franchise.
They are the Taliban to his America.
They
That's
are
how much he hates this.
They are worse than ISIS. no, that's a little extreme. Nobody died because of these movies, but yeah, I couldn't stand them, and I have a two to three page write up on just trashing the Amazing Spider-Man 2. It's actually like my pride and joy, and one of these days I'll release it to the world. Yeah, I couldn't stand it. And so I was really, really happy. I remember I was actually in my, I was doing my internship, and I was on the night shift. I did my internship for criminal justice, so I was out on patrol. And this one dude, there wasn't very many of them, but this one guy I actually really liked. He was kind of cool. He was talking to me about some of this geeky stuff, and literally that night, the article came out that Marvel and Sony made a deal, and that they're going to introduce Spider-Man into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And man, I just remember it felt like Christmas that night. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think it was, but it should have been snowing that night, because it was like white Christmas to me. I even cried a little. I think I got to go home early. I was ecstatic though. Man, and so it felt like a long time coming. And again, like you said, there was a lot of drama because of that Sony hack. And it didn't affect just the Spider-Man. You know, it affected Seth Rogen and James Franco's movie, The Interviewer, or whatever that was called, with mm-hmm. Korea. It affected David Fincher, Angelina Jolie, with a lot of the movies that they were planning on with Sony. And, you know, Spider-Man actually, at the end of the day, came out better than ever. But it really felt like they were the only ones that actually benefited from the leak. Yeah, because, I mean, let's call it as it is. You know, I could say, you know, till I'm blue in the face that Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man, that is, sucked. But the truth of the matter is that while they were not as financially stable as the first, well, any of the three Sam Raimi ones, they were successful. Like, they all made money.
Mm-hmm.
And that, at the end of the day, if the leaks didn't happen, Amazing Spider-Man 3 and Sinister 6 would be a reality. You know, it had nothing to do with the fact it was critically panned. There's no debate about that. But they were still going to continue to make the Amazing Spider-Man movies, you know. It had nothing to do with the fact that they weren't making money. So, as much as I'd like to think that they made no money, they were very successful. So, it was going to continue, but then these leaks happened, things happened, and now we have Spider-Man Homecoming. This is all kind of a very long preamble to why Spider-Man Homecoming is amazing, and that's because it's new, it's different. It's not an origin story. Kevin Feige, when he got the rights back, and let's be very clear, Marvel Studios got all of the money for Civil War. Sony did not get any money for Spider-Man presence in Captain America Civil War. That movie made over $1 billion, and Marvel Studios got all of that. Sony did have to give permission and sign off on Spider-Man's appearance, but they got no money for that movie. Now, mm-hmm. Spider-Man Homecoming, which, for better or worse, is produced by Marvel Studios, but is a Sony Pictures movie. So, we now have Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios producing this movie, and basically, this is what Sony is. Sony's like, take this movie, go make it amazing, and it was, and we will distribute it, and Sony gets all the profits. Marvel Studios got, I'm sure, some profit for being producers, but at the end of the day, whatever Spider-Man Homecoming makes is Sony's money. It's not Marvel's money.
Yeah.
Marvel will get the Spider-Man boost next year during Avengers Infinity War. They get all the profits for that movie. So it's kind of this really, really unprecedented and strange thing that we're living in right now, because basically we get Marvel Studios produced movies, but they're not Sony movies. So it's still, at the end of the day, a Sony Spider-Man. It's just better. So, and it is really strange, and yet it's cool, because we get to have Spider-Man in the universe that we love, and, you know, mm-hmm. as of right now anyways, we're getting good Spider-Man movies again. So it's kind of a win-win, and it's going to eventually come to another head. Eventually contracts do die, and at that point mm-hmm. we will once again be kind of left in limbo of like, what's gonna happen now? And from what we know, that's not that far away. Technically, Marvel Studios is only contracted to make Spider-Man Homecoming 2. They are not contracted anything past that. This will be a very relevant topic in the near future. Spider-Man Homecoming 2 is the first movie after Avengers Infinity War, or I mean, I was going to say part two, but it's Avengers 4, the untitled Avengers movie, which is basically going to be the end of this Marvel Cinematic Universe that we know and love, and Spider-Man Homecoming 2 is going to kick off a new phase for Marvel Studios. It's very interesting. We'll see where all that kind of goes. I think that we're going to be seeing Marvel Studios produced Spider-Man Homecoming movies for a very long time. I don't think that Sony is dumb enough to not renew this contract, but I've seen crazier things, so we'll kind of approach that as need be, but we should probably actually start talking about this movie. So, crazy, crazy good. I don't know where exactly, even after seeing it 3 times, that it fits in my Spider-Man ranking. I have such a nostalgia factor for the first two, especially the Sam Raimi ones, that it's hard for me to like it. I know it's up there with them. I don't know if I can necessarily put it above them. But I do know that it's at least in the conversation for me, which is, I think, a huge win, because nothing's even ever come close to that. So I said it in the first episode, I'll say it again. Spider-Man is my boy. Like, he is me incarnate into comics. Like, if I could identify with any character in the comic books, it's Spider-Man. I see myself and him, and he just has this relevance to me that is completely it's emotional, and I love it. And so it's one of those things where ride or die. Spider-Man's my ride or die, you know what I'm saying? To see another good Spider-Man movie is one of my favorite things about this movie. Is there's so many just little things. Like, it doesn't feel forced, but again, it's like this. Spider-Man has such an immaculate world, and I felt in this movie world building. You know, I felt like it was such a great, It set the stage for what this Spider-Man world is going to be from this point forward. You know, you have villains that pop into this, like the Prowler, which is the uncle for Miles Morales. You get a reference to Miles Morales. You get the Vulture. You get the Tinkerer. You get Shocker. You get Scorpion. Mm-hmm. You know, you get all of these cool little side characters, and some of them aren't hardly relevant at all, but they have these implications for what the future could be. And I love it so much. And it was really one of the most fun theater experiences I've had all year.
To really understand what I like so much about Homecoming, it's worth talking about what I liked about Amazing Spider-Man compared to the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans. You are much more attached to these movies than I am. I did not like Tobey Maguire at all. Ugly crier, Olympic gold medal. And the thing that they did was they really did a whole lot with the base material of Spider-Man and really kind of brought it to a AAA cinematic experience level, right? And what Amazing Spider-Man did was it kind of brought back a lot of what makes Spider-Man the character so identifiable and so special. The big deal with Peter Parker is he's a kid, right? He's a teenager. He laughs and he makes jokes to cover his insecurity. I mean, he's brand new and he's not sure he knows what he's doing, which is everybody at 17. Literally everybody at 17. A lot more of that came through with the Garfield characterization, but even more came through with this. Cameron's gonna have to give me the name because I'm terrible with these names.
Tom Holland,
which messes me up because there's another Holland somewhere in, I feel like, again, I'm not the names guy. Cameron will back me up. But so much of Tom Holland's character really took a lot of what Andrew Garfield's character did really well and really doubled down on it to do a really true to interpretation Spider-Man comic. You can look at a lot of the interviews that Stan Lee does, because it's a common question he gets all the time. Why is Spider-Man such a special character? And he says all the time, you know, Spider-Man is everybody. Yep. Everybody's been where Spider-Man is. And maybe we don't all have the superpowers, right? But we all do have challenges. We have people we've disappointed. We have things we failed and things that we've succeeded at. And so much of that universal human experience came through in this movie, which I think is what makes it really special. It really makes it like a Spider-Man movie, right? You know, we like Iron Man a lot. I like Iron Man quite a bit. The character of Iron Man, he's an arrogant playboy who's also a mechanical genius with access to an unlimited amount of money. I don't have anything in common with that experience.
No.
Literally zero, right?
Literally zero.
Yeah, I like cars. That's it. But everyone's been where Spider-Man is, and I think keeping the story really down to earth, keeping the first villain relatively down to earth, right? You didn't jump the shark and put Venom right up against him right at the top, but we started with the Vulture. Is a huge throwback to Amazing Spider-Man number one. The Vulture was actually Spider-Man's first villain in the comics.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm open to constructive criticism from the Sam Raimi franchise. To me, there is something that is, and it's hard for me to admit, again, because I'm such a diehard fanboy for those movies, but to me, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movie presents the best Peter Parker, and the Amazing Spider-Man franchise presents the best Spider-Man in the mask. And for me, this movie is the Spider-Man movie that combines both of those, as far as a personality goes, perfectly. For me, when I felt that Tom Holland was out of the mask, I felt that he was the perfect Peter Parker. And when he was in the mask, he was the perfect Spider-Man. And I felt like those were two elements, that element was missing in both of the original franchise movies for Spider-Man. Because for me, I never believed Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker, especially when one of his first high school interactions is him coolly skating down the hallway. But I also never believed that Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man behind the mask was the Spider-Man that I read in the comics, because outside of his wrestling scene in the first movie, whenever Tobey Maguire put on the Spider-Man mask, he was just a hero. And I mean, that was great and that was fine for the movie, but you know, there was not that quippiness that Spider-Man readers at least were used to, right? Like, Sam Raimi created a very serious Spider-Man movie, so much so that, I mean, literally at the end of the first movie, you know, like, you're seeing Spider-Man pretty much get completely busted up by the Green Goblin. And I remember seeing it with my mom, right? And she was like trying to cover my eyes because it was actually pretty brutal. And I felt like that's what Homecoming did so well. It was such a perfect combination of both of these dual personalities that you're kind of, and I felt like for me, and it's not so much a dual personality, but it just felt consistent, I guess. You know, the complete way through with Tom Holland. When he was out of the mask, you knew what he was going through. Like, he was a high school kid that is super powerful and is easily one of the most BA comic book characters ever. But because he's a loser, it doesn't matter in his day-to-day life, you know? And I love seeing that conflict of, okay, do I go to the dance or do I go stop the supervillain? And that's a choice, and that's mm-hmm. a choice that he has to make. It's called the Parker luck. And the Parker luck is never good for Parker. It's always, no. You are going to sacrifice something you love because you have a greater responsibility. And that, to me, is something mm-hmm. that's so emotionally resonant with the Spider-Man story. And I felt like that's what they got right. His life is completely messed up this entire movie. He barely gets to have any friends. The one friend that he gets mm-hmm. to have, who is amazing in the movie, Ned, only really gets to continue yes. to be his friend because he secretly finds out that he's Spider-Man. So it kind of it breaks down that barrier of like being two different people. So now he gets to be the same person with him all the time. And that's what he needed. So I love that they did that. But everybody else, any relationships that he has going forward is going to fail because he is going to have to choose Spider-Man first above all else. That is so perfectly put into the movie by the homecoming dance. Mm-hmm. He gets the girl. He gets to take her to the dance. But guess what? His luck runs out because he opens the door and the villain is her father. And the father is smart and in a perfectly choreographed way, he figures out he's Spider-Man. And so he basically is told to, you know, take off his big boy pants and just be a kid or he's going to die. And Peter Parker had to make that choice of, well, I'm putting on my big boy pants and it's the Spider-Man costume and I'm going to take you down. And that also means ditching your daughter at the dance and completely destroying any relationship that he could have had with her, and destroys it even more by the end of the movie, obviously. So, you know, it's really beautifully done. And it's just kind of one of those things where it was like they understand the character, even though this is the sixth entry that we've seen line of live action of a Spider-Man movie. It felt like we were still touching on new things, but also mm-hmm. getting to see just a normal Spider-Man movie at the same time. So I think it really is to be commended for that, because the one thing that walking out of this movie that was really surprising to me was that it didn't feel super cinematic, you know? Like, you can't name one time in this movie that he is actually swinging in Manhattan. And they make such a point of not doing that because we've gotten that for the last five movies. And this movie, they really tried to drive home that he's from Queens. And so there's nowhere to swing around. They really play on that for pretty much the entire movie. I loved all of that. And it felt new and fresh. And that's really what they needed.
Well, and I love it too as like a hero movie, right? So many of all the Iron Man movies, he's the hero, but his primary motivation is winning, right? Mm-hmm. Iron Man 1, he has to take his company back, which is his birthright, from this guy who wants to do bad stuff, right? So that's kind of a heroic sort of thing. Still pretty selfish, though, which is, that's Tony Stark. The second one, okay. See, I mixed up the second and the third ones in my brain. Who's the main villain in Iron Man 2?
Iron Man 2 is Whiplash, and it's kind of just like dealing with the father's sins.
I like it a lot. It's still not like Tony's actions are selfless in Iron Man 2.
No.
Iron Man 3, another problem Tony creates because he's arrogant and he has to go clean it up, right? And I can go down the line. I think one of the only really heroic characters in the MCU is Captain America, who is so heroic that he basically gets kicked out of everything and he's now underground, I think. Is that correct? After Civil War, he's underground with Bucky.
Yeah, no, he's pretty much nomad from this point forward.
Right. And so we got to have a movie. Every decision Parker makes, he makes out of a sense of duty and out of a sense of moral obligation to do the right thing, which is the whole, if I want to get on my community consciousness soapbox, that's the whole value that these movies provide, right? Beyond entertainment value. It's about a teenager who is 15 years old who still decides to make the self-sacrificing decision and do the right thing. It doesn't all work out for him in the end, but in a way it kind of does, right? He gets the important things are what he gets, and the stuff he gives up is not that important. They did a really good job of keeping that tonally consistent. I think it would be a really easy in this movie to really screw up his motivations halfway through, or to just not keep his motivations really consistent, especially when you're dealing with a 15-year-old kid. I've never met a 15-year-old who is internally consistent. So having one that is genuine, but also makes sense as a character, is a testament to the writing skill that went into it, and I don't think it's good to gloss over it just because it didn't pop out as, like, broken, which is, like, normally what we do, is we'll point out the stuff that's broken, and the stuff they do well is like, okay, well, you do your job, here's a cookie, right? But in this case, it would have been really easy to screw it up, and I'm really happy they didn't.
It's very strange that now two movies in, they've yet to, like, reintroduce that whole with great power comes great responsibility thing. Like, I can't believe they just don't say it. Like, it's just such a staple for mm-hmm. him that it feels weird for them not to. But you know what? They keep getting that message across, but yeah, you're right. I mean, they completely nail that aspect of the character. And yeah, and I think it'll be interesting because I think they will kind of go a little bit deeper into what happened, at least with Uncle Ben and all of that. They kind of made him take that leap of faith. But I like, you know, that they're avoiding that for now. They're trying to be something different. That's cool. And so for them to just show it this time around, again, is just kind of another breath of fresh air that he doesn't necessarily, he's not motivated by somebody else telling him, hey, you need to go do this. Like he finds that responsibility on his own and he finds confidence in himself throughout this movie. Because one of the other things that I love is that he sucks at being Spider-Man in this movie. You know,
no, he's really bad.
He's really bad. He keeps messing up other people's lives being Spider-Man. You know, he has his friend in this gas station sandwich shop. And just one night on patrol, he's doing his thing. And it wasn't necessarily his fault, but he didn't control the situation. And his friend paid the price. You know, and that just continues to happen throughout the movie. He basically destroys the Washington Monument. He tries to stop the Vulture, ends up getting himself trapped and damage control. And, you know, he just keeps failing, but he's got that resilience and he just keeps fighting. Eventually, he wins the day, but there's still, you know, consequences for him winning, too. So it's just one of those things where it hits a lot of notes and it really touches on him really well. And it's exciting now to see where it'll go moving forward. And I'm actually really excited about potential villains and stuff like that. I'm also worried about some potential villains because of other news. Like, I really hope that they take that leap and they actually, like, go with the Scorpion. Because that guy, he plays the villain in Far Cry 3. He plays a supporting character in Better Call Saul. He's actually a really, really untapped actor in this day and age. And so I think getting him, the Scorpion, is a huge come up for them. And I hope that they actually try to use that. I'm not saying he's gonna be the villain, but I think it'd be cool if he was like that supporting character, kind of maybe even like the Shocker in this movie. I just like that there's great potential to go. And obviously he's going to be in Avengers Infinity War, and as we know from the leaked trailer, he is going to be wearing that Iron Spider suit, so that's very interesting.
Sick.
Yeah, and then one thing we haven't really touched on is he actually has a pretty cool relationship, as we see continued on from Captain America: Civil War, with Tony Stark. A lot of people thought this was going to be too much for the movie, for Tony Stark to be a supporting character, and that it would turn into an Iron Man movie. But I actually felt that he had the perfect amount of screen time, and that it didn't overshadow anything in this movie. It was just a really cool tie. So
I agree. And I think going back to really enjoying the potential for this show, a lot of that, I think, comes from the fact that they stripped away so much of the unnecessary crud that's attached to this series, right? It's one of the longest running superhero franchises that has been in film. I think maybe was the first one of the first Hulk movies maybe before Spider-Man 1, or was that even after that?
No. Yeah, Spider-Man. I mean, the only thing that was before Sam Raimi's Spider-Man was 1999's X-Men movie, you know, as far as the Marvel licenses go. And Blade, I guess. Blade.
We won't count Blade. Blade, I think there was a Spawn movie, too. But we've had Spider-Man for a long time. And you mentioned that there's no swinging in the streets of Manhattan, right? And that started with Sam Raimi. They kept it with Amazing Spider-Man. All the web swinging and all the cinematic moments, all of the get all the crane drivers to do their cranes over the lane so he can swing because he had such a hard time swinging before. They didn't actually make the movie better, right? No. It didn't even necessarily make it even more cinematic, right?
That scene.
It was just money spent.
Yeah.
And so you take all that crap out. You even take out Uncle Ben, which, yeah. And I think he'll pop up. But
too.
If you're not going to do the origin story, you don't need Uncle Ben. Hate to say it, but you don't.
No,
and
really.
So they take out Uncle Ben as a character. They really strip out everything you don't need. I don't know if the love interest in this movie, if she's a love interest from the comic books. Only thing we got as a reference to any of Pete's love interest is the given initial name for the kind of the sarcastic loner who's always drawing pictures of people pouting in detention. And she says, my friends call me MJ. And everyone's supposed to be like, oh, okay, I get that, right? But that's it, right?
Yeah.
There is a really minimal love interest plot here. There's a really minimal relationship between the villain and Spider-Man, right? It really is super focused on I'm 15 and I have responsibilities and I suck at that,
yeah.
Right? Which is the absolute core of what Spider-Man is. And it gives them so much headroom to grow when they don't shoot themselves in the foot, basically by making a movie where its reach extends its grasp.
It was really refreshing to me, at least, to watch a movie that's really the only romance. I mean, really, was actually a bromance. That was really cool. Because you're right. I mean, they have now room to start introducing romance into these. Especially with him, you know, for Spider-Man Homecoming 2 or whatever. Because I believe he was a sophomore in this movie, so he'll be a junior in the next one. So it makes a little bit more sense to maybe start going further down that road, especially leading into, like, a senior year movie. But, yeah, it was really cool just to, like, have this movie that wasn't completely overloaded with, like, oh my goodness, I'm in love with the girl next door. A lot of my motivations are going to be solely based around getting the girl. Instead, this movie is about his responsibility as being a hero. And then trying to, again, find that balance between romance and responsibility further on in the future, I think is just going to make that. It's going to make the Spider-Man No More moment for this franchise to be that much more relevant, because it's really going to feel like he's negating his responsibilities if we've seen how important that is to him, especially in a few movies leading up to that. Maybe about the whole MJ thing, it's a weird situation. If I'm being totally honest, like, I wish they would have not called her MJ. And it's not because I'm like, oh, MJ can't be somebody other than a white redhead. It's not about that to me. It's just it's like, if she's not going to be Mary Jane, like, I would have much rather her character just be named Mary Jane and then she does that whole thing and reveal at the end. But instead, her character is going to still be, I believe it's Michelle Jones. So then, like, I was kind of just like, well, don't call her MJ then, because then it just kind of feels like a cheap thing. And I'm just like, just introduce a new character called Michelle and just have that be a love interest potentially for him. You know, like, I don't need her to have the initials to make me understand, you know, that it's going to be like maybe his thing. It's going to be this Spider-Man's Mary Jane. But I mean, I also understand why they did it too. But I was just kind of like, eh, that was kind of like the one thing in the movie, like the reveal, that I was like, oh, I didn't need that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really, like, affect me one way or the other. Some people, of course, are, like, getting their pitchforks and their torches, and they're starting to march down the streets down to Disney, and I'm like, eh, whatever.
I think it's hilarious, because no one's going to get upset that Flash Thompson is not 6'4", white, with blonde hair, right? He is a short little brown dude, and it still works really, really well.
Oh, yeah.
But no one's getting upset about Flash Thompson. They're just upset because there are way too many pinup posters of MJ on the walls of America. To give her a different image is going to make a whole lot of the kind of people who get upset about that sort of thing extremely upset.
I guess we'll just kind of recap our quick thoughts about Spider-Man Homecoming and then probably wrap this up. So for me, Spider-Man Homecoming, a great, great addition to not only the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but is really a return to form, at least for me anyways, to a Spider-Man that I'm looking forward to grow. You know, Kevin Feige's come out and basically said that they want to kind of take a Harry Potter style to these movies with Spider-Man, and basically do for every year going forward, you know, a different Spider-Man story that's a different year in school. So next year will be, or Homecoming 2 will be junior year. Homecoming 3 will be senior year, which you can kind of see the relevance to that. Like, the end of a trilogy is going to also be a huge end of an arc for a young person our age, 17, 18, mm-hmm. whatever he's going to be in the movie. And so that's really, really cool. And, you know, whether or not that goes into college or whatever, you know, however long they want to continue to make these movies. But you can see it, right? Like, you it's like the first time ever that I'm just like, oh my goodness, I can't wait to get to the Deathly Hallows of this franchise. You know what I'm saying? Give me 7, right. Give me 8, you know? I'm just like, tell me these stories, and I want to watch this kid grow up and to see his trials and tribulations. And I think that is where this is going, and I think that they created a really solid base to build that off of.
I agree. I think my final words on Spider-Man Homecoming is, I really, instead of it being a Bentley car with a huge engine and a whole lot of extra crap, it's a Ferrari. It's just got the engine and a seat and a steering wheel, and it does a whole lot with what it does. And I'm really excited to see what they do with it in the future. Go buy it. Go see it. Hang the poster up on your wall. Get excited.
Definitely. I think that's going to do us for episode 2. Once again, as always, thank you for joining us. Thank you for continuing to support us. Share, like this. We're going to be up here on iTunes shortly. But for now, you can catch us over at our website for Hero Cafe. As always, follow us on social media. I'm at Cam Bowes. Follow Sam. He's at Space Eraser. Until next time, we will catch you at the cafe. Now there's talk of, like, is Jared Leto going to be in it? Is it not? It's like, I don't know. Maybe. But just make a good movie.